my fellow citizens of this great country of ours, the United Corporations of America. Now, this is all about freedom. The freedom to sit on your big, fat ass all day and watch the singly greatest sporting event known to man. Welcome to the Death Race.
Ready for one last dance.
We are moments away from the starting gun.
Our racers are scored on total time and combined pedestrian fatalities. With 10 points for an adult, double that for a child, and a whopping 50 points for the senior set.
This year, cutting-edge technology from UCA puts you, the home viewer, in the passenger seat in stunning virtual reality.
They cut my feed.
What about Frankenstein?
I think Frankenstein will be extinct tomorrow.
Are you ready?
Let's score these fuckers.
See how I'm doing it?
I say those points get split right down the middle.
What is wrong with you?
Oh, and by the way, just for the record, my hair, I think it's pretty cool.
And welcome to a special episode of The Spoiler Room. I am your host, Mark Movie Man, and tonight we have a very special guest here with us. We've got a couple of great crew members, and we're talking Death Race 2050. In the room tonight, first, we have the diva of The Spoiler Room, Dawn. She's with us. Hello, Dawn.
Good evening, gentlemen.
And by Dawn as well, we have Andrew Shearer. He's back with us as well. Hello, Andrew.
And you're supposed to call me lovely, man.
I'm sorry. I missed the lovely. The lovely Andrew Shearer is with us tonight.
Lovely.
Thanks, man. How are you?
You're welcome.
I'm good, man. I thought we were going to talk about La La Land, so I'm
No.
Get the fuck out of here.
And our very special guest in the room tonight, he is the director of Death Race 2050. It is G.J. Eichternkamp. How are you tonight, GJ?
I'm all right.
I appreciate you joining us on our little sliver of the internet here to talk about Death Race 2050. And I guess the first question I have is, I remember when there was word that this was first coming out, there were people that were saying it was a sequel, and there were some that were saying it's a remake. How would you categorize this ad? Is this a remake of the Death Race 2000?
Well, what's the difference between a remake and a reboot? Can anybody tell me that?
That's a god. Didn't we do a whole show about that one time?
That was our very first episode trying to figure out exactly what the difference is, because I still am not sure.
It's something more like a remake than a sequel is, I guess, the long and the short of it. I mean, it's a little bit confusing to people because they have the Death Race movies that came out in the 2000s. It started with Jason Statham, and it was just called Death Race, and it was really serious. And then there was a few more of those that went straight to video. And I can't really say this is a reboot because they're still going to make those. So it's not like we're starting over again with the franchise. They're still going to remake those action-heavy, non-comedic, Jason Statham-started Death Race movies. This is more just sort of a reimagining of the first one. And it's sort of what I would imagine would be a one-time thing. So it's kind of a remake, reimagining of the original 1975 Death Race 2000.
Yeah, and I recently watched the original Death Race as well, and I did see some of the similarities in there with it. So what inspired you to do a remake of Death Race 2000?
Well, it wasn't my idea.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes you write and direct stuff, and sometimes stuff comes to you, and in this case, I'd worked with Roger Corman previously on something, and he called me up and said, "Hey, I have a movie I want to do." Originally, he was going to do a remake of Slumber Party Massacre, And I'd been talking to him about that for a while. Then he calls me out of the blue and says, forget Slumber Party Massacre. I want to do a remake of Death Race 2000. And I was actually pretty excited about it because it's sort of one of his most iconic, if not the most iconic movie that he's ever done. And it's a movie that I had remembered seeing and then really enjoyed. And what I really loved about it was the potential to do the sort of the satire and the comedy and the kind of that sci-fi way of imagining, you know, taking apart culture and imagining ridiculous things if extended into the future. And I thought, well, this is like my dream project. And so it was really his idea. And I think the reason why he wanted to do it was because of all the things that have sort of come after it that have stolen its ideas. I mean, I think Hunger Games in particular, he was like, you know, Hunger Games is popular. Death Race was kind of the first Hunger Games. I should remake Death Race. And then I just agreed to do it, basically.
And then how long did it take you to write the script? You co-wrote it with another individual, correct? Matt?
Yamashita, yeah. Yes. Well, it's funny. The actual longest part of the process wasn't so much writing the script. It was actually doing the outline. I started with this like 4-page outline that just kept getting expanded until it was like a 25-page outline because we kept trying to add more and more and more stuff to it. Roger had all these ideas, you know, a lot of things he wanted to see. He really wanted there to be a character named Tammy the Terrorist. That was his idea, you know. He wanted there to be a self-driving car. That was another one of his ideas. I came up with the genetically engineered guy and also and Minerva, who was the rap star. And then we just kept throwing ideas back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And so finally it got to a point where I was like, look, I might as well just write the thing. The outline's so long. And it didn't take that long. It was a pretty rushed process. You know, they wanted to get it off the ground quick. So I wouldn't say that it took a long time to write at all, but it was, I mean, I kind of used a lot of the sort of the structural beats from the original. So it was almost like taking all the beats from the original and just reimagining them with a different world and different characters. But you could criticize the film for that because it really does, it does kind of follow a very similar structure to the first Death Race, but it worked. So I figured, well, why not go with it? You know, change some significant things, but you know, the five drivers and the five co-pilots and all that thing and the resistance and the resistance spy. It all seemed to be hard to imagine redoing Death Race 2000 without all that stuff.
Well, it, the way the story is structured, I always thought too, is one, you don't, it doesn't necessarily have to be linear. It is kind of a story that you watch this and you could almost work it in as being a sequel in a way. I mean,
yeah, well, there's no sense to it. I mean, it's a crazy world. You can pretty much get away with anything. I mean, yeah, it could have been a sequel. It could have been that the original Frankenstein's revolution failed, you know, and we're back to where we started from and they've just been calling guys Frankenstein forever.
I mean, you know, you do the old history repeats itself.
Sure.
I mean, Hollywood, big name, you know, the big screen, wide release, huge expensive films have been doing that for ages. So, yeah, I mean, it's you could easily do it, fit it in there as well. And so, yeah, I liked all the beats and stuff. Were there specific scenes, favorite scenes of yours that you really wanted to kind of work into the film, you know, from the original?
Well,
give an ode to because the one scene, especially with the wheelchairs, I thought particularly was a nice ode to the original.
Yeah, the wheelchair scene was definitely iconic, and I wanted to do something like that, even though we didn't have trampolines, unfortunately, so I couldn't like really send them into the air. But the announcers in particular, I kind of wanted to steal. I really wanted the announcers to be very, very similar. I loved the announcers in the first one so much. I thought it would be okay to just almost carbon copy them a little bit. I was really torn about the hand grenade because a hand grenade is kind of a thing everyone mentions when they talk about Death Race 2000 and how he has a grenade in his hand and he calls it a hand grenade. But I think because that was sort of a crucial plot point in the movie where that's how he kills Sylvester Stallone's character, I thought I'd rather subvert the expectation that one time and not have the hand grenade and actually have his hand be an actual cyborg hand, which I thought would be kind of fun because I just kept imagining him squishing a guy's head with it. And I was like, yeah, I want that.
Well, I know I liked the whole robotic hand thing. It almost had a little bit of a feel of, you know, Luke's robotic hand at one point when he's digging in there and he's working on it as well.
Well, man, all my favorite movies have robotic hands in them. I mean, Star Wars, RoboCop, Terminator. I mean, there's that whole thing with the freaking hand in T2 and how important it is that the hand got left behind. I mean, I think a robot hand is always something you want.
And what kind of films did you pull from besides the original Death Race that kind of inspired you? You mentioned Hunger Games, and the announcers definitely felt like announcers pulled from the original, but their costuming and hair kind of reflected more, a little more of the Hunger Games a bit. Was that intentional?
The hair at any given time, you know, I was very busy and I didn't actually have a lot of time to, you know, people would show up and go into makeup and sometimes it'd be their first day on set and I'd be off shooting something else. And a lot of times I didn't really know how they were going to come out looking like. So with Charlie Farrell's hair, the guy who plays JB, he came out of the room that morning with that hair. And I was like, huh, that looks a lot like the character in the Hunger Games. Oh, well, let's just go with it. I don't have time to change it. I mean, so I think it was really his hair more than anything. It kind of is that Stanley Tucci-esque tower of hair that he's got. But I think that was just the most interesting thing they could come up to do with it that day. So I just rolled with it. But
it works with the rest of the, with the outfit of the female. I'm horrible with names right now. With
Grace.
Yes, with her character, it worked well with those two. I really liked the costuming with them and that kind of a fallback. And these characters, I know Andrew, you mentioned it. We were talking about it, how you rather enjoyed the Minerva character.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the whole thing. It's exactly what I wanted Death Race to be when it came back. I don't know if you guys all remember, but Tom Cruise at one point was talking about doing like Death Race 3000 or so. I don't know how long ago that was, but when they just did the Death Race, I'm like, is this the best you could think of? Was just to like strip it down, you know? So I wasn't into that. So I love the world that this is. Everything is completely insane and appropriately so. You know, like anytime you would hear about them wanting to do, if you know, if there's ever a Death Race sequel or update, they said, you know, it should be gory, it should be, you know what I mean, this movie is all the things people always said it should be. And Minerva is just probably, like, to me, one of the best examples of that. I love I just love how filthy everybody's mouth is. I just love like all of that. But she, this is spoiler room, right?
Yeah.
Is that what we're doing?
Yeah. Put spoilers in. So.
Okay. So before she dies, her line, "I see God and she's black as fuck," got to be one of the best lines, period. 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 I was like, that did not just happen. I will say this with the director in the room. This is better than probably anyone expected this to be. I honestly thought it would be kind of like Sci-Fi Channel grade stuff. But this is, I ran out and bought it immediately type stuff. So there you go.
Yeah. For the dialogue on this, GJ, how much of it was scripted and did you allow for some improv by the performers?
I'm generally very into improv. But in this scenario, there's always a little bit, you know, people always throw out, you know, lines and things come out in the moment. I mean, with that line you're talking about specifically with, she's black as fuck. It was originally written, he's black as fuck. And it was actually Falake, who was playing Minerva, who wanted to say, she's black as fuck. And I said, even better, you know. But when you're dealing with kind of a really tight schedule and not a lot of time, and you don't have a lot of, you know, time to do multiple takes, you know, if you're really strapped and, you know, you got maybe 2-3 takes tops before you have to move on, you are kind of forced sometimes to stick to the script. Which was more the case in this film. I think it turned out pretty much 99% similar to what was written, with a few fun things added in.
Don, how about you? What character did you enjoy the most out of this?
I really enjoyed, was it Hamilton, Yancey Butler? Yes.
Alexis Hamilton. Yancey Butler owned that role. I thought she was absolutely amazing.
Well, it's funny you mention that role because originally it had been conceived totally differently. We wanted to be sort of equal opportunity offenders. And, you know, kind of doing the old, oh, America's been taken over by corporations is such a old liberal trope that we wanted to kind of poke fun of the right, the left as well as the right. And originally the resistance was supposed to be a bunch of like lame college professors that were constantly talking about, you know, how they were going to do a peaceful protest or, you know, form a committee or write letters to their congressmen or something. And somehow it just evolved, like in the course of pre-production, they just became like people out of Mad Max. And and it just, I don't know how it slipped away from me, but when we cast Yancey, it ended up making sense anyway, because she fit in that world so well. But originally, yeah, they were all supposed to be wearing like corduroy jackets with, you know, elbow protectors and smoking pipes and stuff.
Don, what's that line she has about Dalai Lama or whatever?
Did you ever hear the Dalai Lama talk about committees? No, because he wasn't a fucking pussy.
He wasn't a fucking pussy.
I love the way she smashes a TV with a hammer, too. I just want a gif of that, man. It reminded me of, I remember in Last Dragon where Shonuff comes in, the video jukebox is playing, and he's just kicks the shit out of it. Awesome.
Yeah. There's so many memorable one-liners in here when you were writing this, did those kind of just flow naturally, GJ, or were there some lines that you had come up with that, oh, we have to work it into the script?
Well, I can honestly say that I'm not that funny as a writer. I'm like the more the structure guy. I kind of came up with a lot of the bigger ideas. You know, I've been obsessing for years now with this idea of gross, what is it called? The guaranteed minimum income and, you know, the future of unemployment and automation. And I came up with the virtual reality stuff. Like I kind of had like the big sort of world ideas, but I'm not a funny, I'm not good at writing jokes. And so really most of the funny dialogue was Matt Yamashita. He's really the guy who writes those things, and I don't know how he does it. Honestly, it's magic to me because I don't know. I don't think I could come up with stuff like that.
And there's one character in particular. Now, I first have to ask, how long ago was the script written before you started shooting it?
It was written. Let's see. What is it? It's 2017 now. Okay. So 2020 would have been written like late 2015.
Okay. Yeah. And the only reason I asked that is because you have the character of the chairman played by Malcolm McDowell. Did you think your script was ever going to be prophetic?
No. No. At the time when I wrote it, or when Matt and I wrote it, we had this running gag that it would be hilarious if the film had Nicolas Cage doing an impression of Donald Trump as the president of the United States of America. And we thought that would be just the end of everything we'd ever wanted to see in our lives. And what happened was, well, we couldn't get Nicolas Cage, but at the time, you know, Donald Trump, I think we had just, you know, gone into like some debates. There might have been some, you know, like large scale Republican primary discussion of who the people were going to be. But he wasn't, you know, the nominee. He wasn't close to being the nominee. And he certainly wasn't even much further away from anyone imagining in a million years he could be president. So when I thought that was a funny idea, it was purely that. It was a ridiculous, hilarious idea. But, you know, so we gave him the hair, but at the same time, we were like, well, we don't want to do an actual Trump impersonation because that might just seem really dated. You know, like no one's going to remember him a few years from now. He's just going to be that creep that always tried to run for president and they never got anywhere. So that's why it's like references him, but it's not, you know,
sure.
Mendicine, you know, we didn't want to go that far with it. We didn't think, we didn't think it was going to be that relevant, you know?
What did Malcolm McDowell think of the role? He seemed to really get into it.
Well, he called me, you know, we shot in Lima, Peru, and he called me up and, you know, he was just like, oh yeah, typical great scenery chewing, ridiculous bad guy. It's fun. I love it. I think for him, he likes having fun, but also I think he sort of enjoyed the world, and I think that it appealed to his sensibilities. I think some of the people that we could have gone to for that role might have maybe been offended by the script, but I get the sense that he actually has an equally perverse sense of humor as I do, so he seemed like he really embraced it. And yeah, and I think
not
he just...
Caligula.
Yeah, exactly.
Not him.
That did have kind of a little bit of a feel to it in his office with a lot of the topless people who just stood around by him.
I definitely thought that. I you know, originally there weren't going to be topless women in that scene. And then when I thought, oh, we've got Malcolm McDowell, I was like, well, he's surrounded by boobs.
Yes.
It is perfect. I was looking at it going, oh, that feels kind of like, I wonder if he's having flashbacks to his Caligula days. The other cast in here is great. For Manu, was he one of your first picks for it, or did you try a few different people for Frankenstein?
No, when you're casting the main roles in these sorts of lower budget movies, they want a number of recognizable people, and that opens me up to be able to audition most of the roles. And then there's other roles where, you know, you want to go for someone who has recognition or a fan base. And they kind of gave me a huge list of people that Universal gave me a list of people that they thought, you know, would be appropriate. And I combed through the list and I was like, well, this guy, I looked him up and I said, this guy seems like the best guy for it. And, you know, watched a ton of his stuff, and then he was the first one we went after and he said yes. So it was kind of like a thing where it was a little sight unseen, where, you know, I had to sort of cross my fingers and hope that he was going to be good, because at a certain level you don't audition people anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, once they're successful enough.
Yeah, because I liked him. I've watched him in a couple of his other you know, besides Arrow, I watched him in a film Beta Test. So when I saw that he was Frankenstein, I thought that was a good choice, because I like it, because he can do that kind of grovelly voice and such. So
yeah, and that was the idea, is that, you know, I tried to imagine that this character would be sort of a parody of masculinity. And when I watched all of his stuff, I thought it'd be kind of funny that you could have this guy who starts off in this mask and he's like, you know, everything I say is going to be rude for no reason. You know, get out of my way, lady. And then he takes the mask off and he's just like, God, it's itchy. God, it's so, you know, that he sort of portrays this idea of this typical kind of gruff masculine guy. But then you kind of find out he's just this normal dude with a normal life. You know, he's got a dog. He's got to clean out the litter box. He's just trying to like do his job. His face gets itchy sometimes. He doesn't like it. You know, it just had to be fun to try to humanize that type of character, you know, like watching Bruce Wayne on the toilet or something.
Don, I was going to ask you, did you have a favorite scene in here that you maybe wanted to ask GJ about at all out of the film? I know there were a lot of great moments, but was there one in particular?
So I had a couple of scenes that I really enjoyed. One of them, and I'm just kind of going to throw them all out there, and if there's anyone you want to particularly mention, that would be awesome. But I like the cat scene, the cat playing with the butterfly. I laughed. I wasn't expecting that. I should have been, but I wasn't. So there was that scene I really enjoyed. I enjoyed the scene at the hotel, the fight between Perfectus and Frankenstein, quite a lot. It was the scene where Perfectus kind of broke.
Oh.
And he was trashing the room and he put the chair over his head and just watching him spiral into insanity. I enjoyed that scene. I enjoyed the way it was shot. I enjoyed the complete, I mean, he was breaking. And I thought it was really well done. And then the last bit, and it was just the very, very part at the end, mm-hmm. where Frankenstein, it was at the very, very end when Frankenstein were talking and the world had ended, the race was over, and everything was all chaos and anarchy. And she asks what they were going to do next. And he said, well,
somebody's got to repopulate.
Yeah.
And
the voice is perfect.
And he looks at her with that, I can't believe I just said that.
Well, I can tell you stories about all of those scenes. Are you ready for them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, there's no director commentary. So this is all we can get, right?
So the cat scene is actually based primarily on a long-standing Hollywood screenwriting book called Save the Cat. Do you guys know about Save the Cat?
Yeah.
Well, the problem with Save the Cat is that it's become literally codified into absolute law. The structure in Save the Cat, the three-act structure that is provided, and the beat sheet that is provided, I don't know if it's like 15 or, you know, something sort of turning points in the story, has become the absolute 10 commandments of screenwriting. And really, it's really impossible nowadays to find a script that doesn't follow the Save the Cat beats, like moment for moment for moment. And I just thought it would be funny if they had an actual opportunity to save a cat, because the theory in the book is that you have to have your main character do something in the very, you know, first 10 pages of the script that makes you like them. And in an 80s movie, it would be climbing a tree to save a cat. So I thought it'd be funny if she wasn't going to save the cat, but he was. But the funniest thing about that scene was when we went out to shoot it, you know, so the thing most people don't know about, like, action movies or movies with action in them, or even movies in general, is that you have a second unit, and that second unit goes out and does a lot of the stuff that doesn't involve the actors. So they go out and shoot like establishing shots. They might go out and shoot drone shots. They might, in an action movie, they're usually the ones who are doing all of the action. They're out there shooting the explosions and the car chases and things like that. So the exteriors of that scene were shot by the Peruvian second unit, and they had this cat that they couldn't figure out how to get it to stay in the road while they were shooting. They were, you know, we weren't ever going to run the car at the cat, but they wanted at least a shot of the cat in the road, but it wouldn't stay in the road. And every time they'd run the camera, it would walk off. So they put this like pile of raw meat on the ground for it to eat. And I get this footage back, and it's this his cat, like whose kitten, whose face is covered in like blood, like scarfing down, just honk, 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 eating this meat. And I'm like, oh man, that's not that cute at all. So I told the prop department to make a butterfly prop just by printing a picture of a butterfly off the internet and gluing two of them together and putting them on a string. And we took the cat and just basically shot him on the studio lot, like basically in a parking lot. And I wasn't convinced it would actually intercut at all. I was convinced that it was going to be really obvious that the cat playing with the butterfly wasn't the same cat that was on the road, because they look completely different. But somehow I think I got away with it, because the cat playing with the butterfly was way cuter than the cat eating the raw meat. The other thing I can say is in that fight scene, this is kind of funny. That was Bert Grinstead, the guy who plays Jed. That was his first scene ever. He showed up in Lima, and we had scheduled it so that unfortunately was the absolute first thing he had to do. And, you know, and he never worked with me, and he didn't quite know the tone of the movie. I mean, necessarily, you know, so I was like, no, go crazy. And he's like, how crazy? I'm like, there's no such thing as too crazy. He's like, I don't believe you. I'm like, no, believe me. One of the things that I think some people have misunderstood about the whole perfectus and his masculinity thing is that it wasn't ever that I was trying to say like, oh, he's gay and he's in the closet and that's what's funny about it, or it's lame because he's gay. It was more just sort of a take on the idea of these ultra, ultra masculine, buff, chiseled supermen that you see in these movies. And sort of the idea that seeing these you know, ripped hard bodies fighting, rolling all over each other with their sweat dripping in each other's mouths was just such a silly, silly, very hot homosexual thing. And so originally the song was Gay Bar, but I couldn't afford it. So I actually commissioned a song for that, where I had a guy I knew write a version of Gay Bar that ended up being called Boys Night Out. And that ended up being the song. And really the thing with Jed was, it was not so much that he's gay or not, it's just how much his masculinity is important to him and what a toxic mindset that is. And that was really more what I was trying to talk about there. And then the other thing that I think you mentioned was the sort of the riot scene at the end and Frankenstein's call to arms, if you will. And I always thought, I mean, not to criticize the original because it's still probably way better than Death Race 2050, but one of the things I always thought was that it ended on this wedding, which seemed, you know, really not punk rock to me to end on a wedding. It seemed like the opposite of punk rock. So I thought, you know, I think a real cult movie should end with just anarchy. A real cult movie should end with the end of the world. All I think all my favorite cult movies kind of end with someone holding hands while nuclear bombs go off. And and I thought, like, so really this is a character flaw in on Frankenstein. This is him being, he's being told, you know, the people will listen to you. You need to fix the world. And he keeps saying, oh, the world's too far gone. The world's too far gone. And finally, he has his moment where he takes the mantle and he looks at the camera and he says, okay, I'm going to fix the world. I'm going to set it straight. And his idea of setting it straight is just telling everybody to hit the streets and just, you know, slaughter each other and see who's left standing. Because when it comes down to it, there's too many of us and we're mostly weak. And really, the only way to fix the problem of the human race is to cull like 90% of us. And that seemed to me like a way more punk rock ending than them getting married and becoming president, or, you know.
it did.
Yeah,
have...
the original Death Race had a happy ending.
Yeah, which was weird. Which, if you look at the whole tone of the movie, I mean, it's kind of a little bit weird. I mean, I know that it's kind of a happy ending that's tongue in cheek. Obviously, you know, it's sort of a parody of a happy ending because, you know, the movie can do whatever the hell it wants. But I don't know. I didn't really believe that Frankenstein and Annie could then change how far gone the world had become. You know, it'd be like saying if Bernie Sanders became president tomorrow, all the you know, white nationalists in this country would somehow calm down.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think that would happen. Yeah, I thought that was a little bit tough in that original ending too, with suddenly not only did he get married, but he's a president. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah, and if society has degenerated to that level of sort of, you know, moral absence, just a complete lack of like respect for human life, I don't know what Frankenstein the president would be do to change that, you know.
can't quite lead by example, I guess.
No, exactly.
Andrew, how about you? Did you have a specific scene or whatnot that you maybe wanted to bring up, one of your favorite scenes besides the I've seen God?
Oh, that was a line of dialogue. Yeah. No, that was, God, it was just wonderful. No, I like the idea of a movie that can do whatever it wants. And I think that, you know, Death Race 2050, this is actually takes a lot of opportunity to improve upon some of this stuff, but it's still, I swear, when I was watching, I was like, you could freeze frame some of this and freeze frame the old one. It really looks the same, which to me is fantastic.
That's on purpose.
Okay. I want to hear about this then, instead of picking out a favorite scene. I want to hear some more behind the scenes type stuff. Cause that is the most delightful part about this movie, I think, is how well it fits. You could watch them back to back.
Well, the thing is, you know, I had to make certain decisions stylistically and tonally based on what I was given to work with. And, you know, the it being Corman and the budget being what it was, I mean, you know, you've got, you know, some money and, you know, it wasn't like it was a completely, you know, like a zero budget movie, but it was a very low budget movie. And it's hard to do the future and to do cars and costumes and racing and action. It's hard to do all that stuff. You know, usually if you have a budget, you kind of focus on the one thing, but these old school Roger Corman movies were trying to be similar to A-level movies. You know, they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. So it was like, we wanted to have the costumes and the cars and the racing and we want all that stuff. And at the end of the day, we're also shooting in Lima, which is sort of a giant desert, and it wasn't exactly, you know, had originally been in the script that it was going to be a giant desert. It was going to ideally look more like America. And so as we were shooting, it sort of occurred to me that there were going to be aspects of it that were going to seem like a B-movie. You know, we weren't going to fool the audience into thinking it was an A-movie. It was going to be, and it was going to have the look and feel of a B-movie. but I didn't want it to feel like Sharknado. I didn't want it to feel just like cheap for the sake of being cheap. So somewhere along the way, when we were color correcting it, I basically said, well, let's try to put like a 70s film filter on this. Let's take a 16 millimeter film filter and put it on this and try to match the sort of Technicolor look of film stock from back then. And so ultimately we tried to actually match the look of it and to fit, you know, to try to say like, hey, to the audience, hey, this looks like something from the past. This is going to feel like something from the past. This isn't going to be your typical digital movie you see on Netflix. I wanted the look of it to feel like the original Death Race, to sort of give the audience an idea that like we knew what we were. Because if the audience doesn't know that we know that that's what we're doing, they're going to be like, what is this? Why is this not Death Race with Jason Statham? You know, I wanted it to be very clear that that was the sort of genre we were aiming for, you know? And that was something we definitely tried to match. And that's really what the color correction, that's something you do in post for the most part. And then the rest of it was just the fact that it was a genuine B movie, and a B movie is a B movie, and you're kind of given the resources you're given. And so in a way, the Corman money kind of equals the Corman look at the end of the day.
Yeah. There's a sticker on the thing that says all new from Roger Corman. And I would imagine anyone who would pick that up and see that should know what that means and should know what to expect. But for me, this is what I was hoping for. And I was really glad that I got, but, you were talking about the beat calculator, the beat sheet or whatever, and how now you can watch pretty much any movie. You're like, okay, now we're at Dark Knight of the Soul.
And
it just goes. And what I wanted to know is that, like, you know, when you hear filmmakers talk about their Roger Corman stories and all of that, a lot of them mention how Page da-da-da, he wants nudity, or Page da-da-da, he wants violence. I wanted to know, with as far as putting the structure together like that, were there any requirements like that that you had to hit? Because I know with Paul Bartel, his wasn't violent enough, and they had to go in there and make him do some more violence or at it themselves. What were your parameters as far as the exploitation type content was concerned?
I mean, I basically stripped the original down to a skeleton of beats, and then I just sort of made sure that, I mean, I kind of just knew it because we were doing 3 days. It sort of just dictated itself, you know, race starts here, first kill here, X amount of time has to pass before you probably have to kill someone else. You know, the first night in the hotel, characters talk, wake up, yeah, next kill happens here. So all that stuff was pretty straightforward. I think that the more difficult thing was the nudity. Roger really wanted a lot of nudity. And I'd never done nudity in a movie before. I always kind of prided myself as the kind of guy who wouldn't really sacrifice getting a good actor for someone that was willing to get naked, and never really wanted to be in a situation where I had to say to somebody like, okay, you know, take off your clothes.
Sure.
But he really wanted a lot of nudity, and I felt like he was right to some degree, because I mean, that was in the spirit of the original. So my logic would be to get the best actors I could for the lead roles, and then just try to stock the secondary characters with people that were willing to get naked. And so all of the proxies were going to get naked. That was the original idea, all of the co-pilots. Uh-huh. But as it turned out, finding a person in Lima who was willing, who could speak perfect English, act, was good looking and willing to get naked to play one of those proxies was basically impossible.
Wow.
There just wasn't a large enough pool of actors. There wasn't a large enough pool of English speaking actors, and there sure as hell wasn't a large pool of English speaking actors willing to get naked in an extremely conservative Catholic South American culture.
Sure.
So it ended up just being extras. You know, it was like they could find me extras, and I started reimagining the whole movie at that point, where I was like, okay, maybe there's just topless girls in that bar. Maybe that's the thing in the future. You go in a bar, it's fashion, toplessness. Put him in the scene with Malcolm McDowell, you know.
Yes.
But he was never, ever happy with the amount of nudity that was in it still. And I was sad to disappoint him in that regard, but it just wasn't easy. It just wasn't something that was easy to get in Lima at all.
Dawn, didn't you have some kind of observation related to the nudity that you were going to mention?
I didn't.
No? Were we just talking about titties before the show for no reason at all then?
Pretty much.
We were just talking about boobs before the show, so that just because.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can't talk about 70s movies without talking about, I mean, they, you know, naked people all over the place.
I mean,
yeah, I thought it was hilarious that at the beginning, when the guy was doing the virtual reality glasses and he goes up to this topless woman at the bar and it turns out to be his grandma.
That was great.
That was great. Yeah.
Well, there's male nipples. I mean, you know, Perfectus is super, you know what I'm saying? Like in the 70s, that probably would have been a woman doing that, right?
Oh, I mean, he spends like a good amount of the movie in a thong.
Yeah, so I think you're covered.
A bedazzled thong.
Yeah. Nipples are nipples. It's 2017.
I mean, it was a weird thing because, you know, traditionally, I mean, where it does break from the formula is that the Annie character would have been naked half the movie. Mm-hmm. And I do think in a way times have changed. I think taking your female lead now and, you know, forcing her to do gratuitous nudity for absolutely nothing. Had there been an extended shower scene of her, I just feel like that's a way that we've changed, or that's the way I'd like to think we've changed, where we'd be like, oh man, you didn't have to make Annie get naked. She was your strong female lead. Like, shit, why'd you throw her in the bus like that?
Oh, you had him pass the Bechdel test and singing at the same time.
And I just want to say about that Bechdel test, I didn't write a scene just to pass it. That scene had always been in there. When they asked me what the name of the bar was, I said, call it Bechdel's Bar. That was more of an afterthought. It's not like I put that scene just in there to pass it.
Yeah, but some of us really appreciate that kind of stuff, man. That's great.
What I liked, what I was wondering about it is, I did notice, even though you have a lot of crazy and outrageous stuff, and it seems like, as I kind of mentioned in my review, that you kind of just took the hinges off and flew with the script, there are points in the script where it does get a bit serious, you know, and I like that. Was that intentional with the script of trying to balance out kind of the craziness with, well, now we actually have kind of a serious part, like the dialogue between Frankenstein and his, Annie, thank you. Frankenstein and Annie, you know, when they get to the room at the second night, you know, where she's, it's revealed she's resistance. There's actually, I like that scene, and it's actually kind of serious. And then there's also the scene with them on the balcony. Was that kind of worked in there intentional, kind of give it a balance?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, Roger said this from the beginning, and I agreed with him, was that you still need something human to anchor the film. And if the relationship between those two doesn't work, you don't have much. I mean, you're coming back to two people that you're actually supposed to be invested in. You can't really have a movie that's just all anarchy. You know, there has to be moments of humanity. And I wouldn't say we dug super deep with those two, but I mean, I tried in my own weird way to humanize them and make them kind of the only two real people in a crazy world. Looking back at it now, I sometimes worry that it feels like a clash in tone, or maybe it doesn't translate. But hearing that you enjoyed those scenes is comforting, because I did invest in them in a different way. You know, when we wrote those scenes, I really wanted it to feel like Frankenstein's a real guy, you know.
Well, that's the real risks that this film takes, and what separates it from, you know, your Troma or your Sci-Fi Channel stuff, or even, you know, most of low budget filmmaking that we see is all like green screens and stuff and comped and everything. So to see real cars out there, real people driving them, real bombs going off, it is actually a more daring film for you know, 21st century than I think anyone was kind of expecting. And so having the drama in there and having it work, the serious scenes, those actors are fantastic at doing that. They're just as good as they are doing the crazy stuff too. With bodies getting cut in half and all that other stuff, that to me was the most shocking thing about the film, is that you guys tried that stuff and totally pulled it off.
Yeah, I do think there was risks, because the tone of it is very peculiar. And I think there's probably a lot of people that won't get the tone or like it, you know, whether it's the fact that they hate the serious stuff in contrast to the crazy stuff, or the fact that the crazy stuff is too crazy for them. But I mean, I do think it's a frequency we tried to create. And I didn't really know, putting it out there, what was going to happen. I was like, pretty scared. I mean, honestly, if I only had one regret, or, you know, I wish we could have had more practical effects. You know, I know that if I was going to be a real purist, I would have said, no, God damn it, this is the 70s and there will be no computer effects at all. But just when it came down to it, it just wasn't possible. There was only so much money and so much time. And so I did have to have some computer stuff in there, but I'd like to think people will forgive it because they know that, you know, it is what it is. You know, you're not always capable of having $1 million to make the biggest, craziest, most amazing Death Race 2050. You kind of have what you have.
Well, big thing with Death Race is the vehicles. And yeah, I was surprised as well as how many, the practical vehicles, functioning vehicles you had in here, and the designs of them really seemed to go a little bit different direction than the original, where the original looked like it was just modded, already existing Volkswagen cars. All of these looked like really original designs. Were they all built from the ground up or modified?
Yeah, they were built from scratch, basically. I mean, we had a woman from the Art Center College of Design here in Pasadena, and they have a very large department that specializes in drawing and designing very futuristic cars. And she did these sort of 3D renders of all five cars, based a little bit on, you know, what Roger wanted, and based a little bit on sort of what I had written in the script for what the car should look like. And then when they sent them to the crew in Lima, they took a bunch of Volkswagens and stripped them down to basically just a floor, a steering wheel, tires, and an engine. And then they built up from that base each car completely from scratch. And they built them really actually out of the bases were styrofoam. And then they covered them in fiberglass and then painted them. And so the cars actually were pretty neat because they were exactly what they had been on paper, which is something that I wasn't expecting. You know, in the originals, they just had what looked like cars with some stuff glued on them. And these turned out to be actually the cool cars that I had imagined, which was great.
Yeah, I like the design of Frankenstein's car, especially with all the eyes.
Yeah. It's the monster.
I didn't actually notice it the first time I watched it, and then I watched it again and go, oh, look at all the, there's two eyes. Oh, four. Oh, there's eyes all over that. But it also, though, still felt like, you know, his car from the original, just a better designed one, I thought, actually. I really liked the Frankenstein car in this. But all the cars I liked were unique in their design as well. Don, did you have a favorite car? Did you like Frankenstein's or which car?
Oh, yeah, I liked Frankenstein's. Mm-hmm. I liked the design of his car quite a lot. Perfectus's car was a little phallic for my taste.
we were constantly trying to name the cars on set because we felt like Frankenstein's car shouldn't be the only car with a name. And we couldn't ever come up. We never agreed on what they should be called, but I'm pretty sure that the actor who played Jed called his car the Inseminator. So.
And I liked how you kind of played it up with the character too, with Perfectus, is the shtick that kind of Sly Stallone's character had in the original, where he took out his pit crew. Only Perfectus, every stop, he's taking out the crew.
Yeah,
I thought that was a nice little interesting shtick, but you used it enough, I think, to where it didn't get tiring, because I think sometimes you get films that have shticks like that or you know, a running gag, but they use it almost too often. So how do you kind of determine that, you know, how often you space that out with you know, when that's going to happen, or to use a specific shtick like that more than a couple times throughout the film? Do you kind of pace it out, look at it through editing, or?
I mean, in that particular case, I mean, we had basically, you know, we had only so many, I mean, you know, you're dividing your time up between shooting the actors in the sort of the scenes where you're focusing on acting. And there's time when you just have to have cars doing car stuff. And then you have action scenes where people are fighting, and then you've got, you know, kills specifically. And I'd always felt that you couldn't have too many kills in this. And so those were just sort of easy kills that we could come up with, where they weren't big ticket items where we needed gore. It was just a quick one-off, have someone fly off camera, Jed's killed somebody, and you're good to go. And because it was only an opportunity to do it two or three times, I thought it was fine. But in general, I felt like anytime we could kill somebody in this movie, we should take it. You know, and some of them were going to be more exciting or more interesting, and some of them were going to be like, ah, fuck it, that guy's dead, whatever, let's move on. Show the guy hitting the ground and we're good.
It was a good head squish in one of those scenes. I think it was when the white people were getting run over. It's fantastic head squish.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you know, a lot of that's the sound effects too. You know, one of the things that really helps kind of sell it, you know, when you don't have the amazing budget to do the full on effects, is sometimes just a great disgusting sound.
Just sweeten the head.
You know, just a skull crushing sound combined with a brain splatter. It's like, does 99% of the work for you.
And in that final, the scene where the resistance is chasing Frankenstein, that looked like a cemetery. Did you guys make all those crosses, or where was that shot? Because I was looking at that going, are they actually running over graves?
Well, so basically, it proved to be very difficult in Lima to get the streets closed down. There wasn't really the same sort of presence there is, say, in LA, where they put a notice up on everyone's door saying they're filming, and then they have police go up and down the streets and clear the roads. I mean, there wasn't a lot of places in the more developed areas where we could film and really be able to control the environment so that there weren't people wandering up and down the streets or cars everywhere. So a lot of the places we filmed were actually military bases. And in the military bases, you know, you have these buildings and roads, but, you know, you you get permission from the government, and then they tell everybody to, you know, stay the heck out of there. So that was actually on a military base. And what we ended up doing was, building the crosses. They just made, you know, hundreds of these little crosses and stuck them in the ground. And at one point we were going to blow up a casket. And the idea was they were going to build this casket and they were going to blow it up, and then, you know, bones would fly everywhere. And it was just the funniest thing, which you couldn't get in Lima. Like, when it came to blowing things up, you know, they could do it until the end of time. You know, they could, yeah, those gasoline explosions were all real. But when it came to them finding a skeleton for me, not possible. They couldn't do
Wow.
it. They could not find a skeleton. They were like, I'm like, don't you have a Halloween store? Like, go get a fucking plastic skeleton. I don't care. And they were like, nah, we don't do Halloween, man. That shit's messed up. Like,
oh, no.
It's like, that's not cool here. We don't do that stuff. That's like devil stuff.
Wow.
We learned something about Peru, I guess.
No, I learned a lot about it. But yeah, it was funny because there were things they could do, you know, they could do great, but, you know, I never knew when I was going to come into a roadblock. And so there ends up being a coffin that explodes technically, but there's nothing in it, so it just kind of looks like some wood or something. That scene, I don't know if you noticed, there's just this random like wood that blows up.
Now we will.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was just an army base, and they had an artist come out and paint all of those paintings everywhere. You know, and a lot of the times I would just wing it. You know, I noticed that he had a painting of Jesus on one of the walls. So I was like, okay, well, let's have a guy fall into a cross, you know, in front of the Jesus painting. Like, let's do it.
But that was okay, and Halloween wasn't.
Yeah.
Killing me.
Halloween, not a thing in Lima, just in case you were wondering.
Jeez. And pillow in front of Jesus, no problem.
You know, that's the thing about filmmaking people don't realize is that, like, you're in a situation where you just do what you can do. Like, you're not always, it's not like you're, like, every moment it's everything you envisioned. You kind of get into a situation, you go, okay, I'm on an army base, there's crosses, there's a painting of Jesus. I don't have a skeleton, but I do, I can, you know, I got this Jesus painting, all right, now what are we going to do here? Like, it's kind of how it goes.
And I think people don't realize that sometimes with especially films on a limited budget, you're doing what you can, not necessarily that you want to do, but people, I think, sometimes miss that point.
Oh, they always miss that point. And you know what? But I don't expect them to, like, here's the thing. I don't expect them to, I don't think anyone should ever forgive a movie for being cheap, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think you should ever forgive a movie because, you know, it didn't go well, or they didn't have money, or, you know, somebody got sick, or, you know, there's a million things that can mess up a movie. And I don't think an enjoyment of something should depend on your preconceived notions of it. You know, yeah, but I don't think it should ever be, yeah, but, you know, the director had cancer when he was making it, so give him a break. Like, I don't think art needs to have an apology. The only thing that bugs me is when people, like, call me out personally. That's the thing that bugs me. Where they're like, Hector and Camp chose to blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I did not. How do you know? You don't know who chose to do anything. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
That was what I was going to ask, because I mean, my friends, everybody that I know that was anticipating this from the trailer loved it. What the reaction has been to this movie. I mean, you're not like on Twitter reading what people say, are you? I would never do that.
Does it hurt? Are you asking me if it hurts?
I'm not. I don't think I'm. Maybe I can be asking if it hurt. It would hurt me. I mean, you know, we can.
No, look, I had very realistic expectations for this. You know, So I've done, and I think this is definitely a good place to. I think this is definitely a natural conclusion to our talk. First thing I ever did was a documentary about my crazy parents, and it was probably the truest thing that I could ever make. After that, I did a remake of that film with Rene Russo and Oliver Platt playing my parents. I think it was good, but I don't ever think it could compare to the original. And both of those movies went to Netflix last year. And I read the comments on the documentary. In the documentary, I still believe to this day is probably the greatest thing I'll ever make. Because of the fact that it's the truest thing I could ever make. I mean, it's real people, and it's people that were my family. So I was able to get something out of them that I don't think you could ever get making any documentary. And the comments on Netflix were like, these degenerates, you know, this director should be working at a gas station, not making films. I mean, all the things.
Aww.
And that was a good movie, you know, like a solid, straightforward, not culty, not B movie, not throwback to the 70s. That was a straightforward documentary film. And anyone who watches a documentary should know what they're getting themselves into, right? It's not like you're saying you're watching Star Wars, you're watching a fucking documentary.
Yeah.
Your expectation should be to see a real story told in a very subtle way. Mm-hmm. And then the remake had a similar response, you know, where people are like, oh, fuck these degenerates, these imbeciles, gas station, fuck this guy. I think that both of those movies now have like a 6 out of 10 on IMDb from the some 200 people that bothered voting. You know, I definitely didn't think that the average person was going to love Death Race. I thought that a lot of them were going to only be familiar with the Jason Statham movies and have their mind blown by just how ridiculously wrong they thought this went because of what they were expecting. I thought a number of people would, you know, just not be on the thought, like that, just not like the humor or relate to it, which is totally natural in anything that's comedic. But honestly, if this film was liked by more than 1 out of 3 people, then I think I'd be failing. Like, right? I mean, if this movie was beloved by all, like Finding Nemo, then I feel like I would have done something horribly, horribly wrong.
So true. Very, very true.
Well, I think we will wrap it up here tonight. GJ, I want to thank you very much for a very entertaining chat and giving us insight onto this fun film. I just like to say personally, I enjoyed it. It was actually a lot better than In all honesty, when I first heard about it coming out, I was like, okay, you know, and then saw it, and I was just, my mind was blown by this film, of just how the energy and how much fun it was. So I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us tonight about Death Race 2050. Do you have anything coming up or anything people should possibly look for you soon coming out or that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I'm working on another project for Universal. It's another film about vehicular manslaughter. It's you know, it seems like every time I do something different, it's very strange. You know, most people kind of have one thing that they do over and over and over again, but I feel like every time I do a movie, it's completely new and not expected. And this one's actually more of a straightforward action movie. It's not funny. It's not comedic. It's more of what it wants to be is a stylish, grotesque sort of action horror movie.
Ooh.
Which is, again, a completely new thing for me. And you know, I'm excited to try it. I feel like anyone who was a fan, it's like basically the rule for me is anyone who's a fan of my last film is going to not like my new film.
Love it.
So it's going to be a totally different kind of vibe, but it's not going to be satirical at all. It's just going to be, you know, like this time it's going to be like actual, you know, cars crashing into buildings and things like that. And so it'll be a new thing and we'll see what happens. I just like to keep doing stuff because otherwise I get bored.
Well, nothing wrong with always trying something different. That's for sure. And do you have a website too as well where people can follow you besides on the IMDb?
Well, I mean, I have a website that I've had since like 2002, which is bionicfilms.com. But at this point, it's not much more than just links to where you can watch things I've done. But I'm on Twitter. I've been trying to do the tweeting.
Yes, the tweeting. So, Don, did you have anything you wanted to say yet about Death Race or ask GJ about?
No, I think that this has been fantastically informational. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was entertaining. I, again, wasn't expecting the next great American film, but, you know, I thought it was fantastic, you know, for what it was, for what it was intended to be.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
And Andrew, how about you? Anything last questions or anything for GJ?
Well, seeing this movie and now knowing that it was made by a very thoughtful person, things are kind of starting to add up in my mind as I'm thinking back on the film, as I'm listening to you. And I can't help but go back to an interview I saw with the author of The Racer that Death Race 2000 was based on. And he recalled this. What started the whole thing was he went to a race with some people and there was a horrible accident. And the audience just starts to cheer and take pictures. And he was really disturbed by that whole thing that happened. And so, you know, he writes this story of it and then they make the movie. And at first he was like, well, they've made a joke of it. But then he realized what they were doing. And he's like, well, satire is the responsible thing to do. It is the way to go. And so when they did the remake with the Statham version, he was very disappointed in that movie because he was like, well, now it's just violence for violence. Like, they've taken out the whole point. Now you're just making a violent movie. And I really agree with that. And the older I get, the more violence for violence sake, really just, to me, it does disturb me because a lot of these films that call themselves throwbacks to the 70s or 80s are very nihilistic. A lot of my friends enjoy, I don't see what they see in them. Death Race 2050 really gets it right. I think the author who passed, I think a couple of years ago, I think he would be very pleased with this. I think he would be very happy. And speaking as a fan of the original and of Paul Bartel's work too, in general, I was really, really happy with it. And it is, to me, is one of the best cult film B-movie type movies to come out in a long time because of the care and the thought that was put into it. So rather than a critique, I just say thanks.
Well, you know, it's funny because you you mentioned the idea of the viewer's relationship to violence, right? And the thing about the original Death Race is it runs a razor's edge to giving you, the viewer, the violence you crave, while also pointing out how horrible you are for craving it. And it gives you a middle finger on one hand and shakes your hand on the other. It says, this is what you want to see. This is what you want to see. And it's like, but you're terrible for wanting to see this, but we know, but we're the same as you. And we enjoy this too. And there's something you can do with satire that to make a person realize that you couldn't otherwise, you know, it's like, I thought it was the weirdest movies. I feel like the weirdest viewing experiences I ever had was the, what is that frickin' the Quentin Tarantino movie, the one before the last one?
Oh, Inglourious Bastards?
No,
Django.
Django. Django. Django was such a fascinating movie to me because it was talking about these atrocities of violence that were committed against Black people in the South, and then it was also just reveling so much in the atrocities of violence. And as much as I thought it was a well-made film, I couldn't help but think, but man, how can you criticize violence while also just be wallowing in it up to your ears in blood? Like, how can you say that you're criticizing violence of any kind when you're clearly giving the audience so much violence? You know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, I think it's only to acknowledge that paradox. It's only by pointing out what a paradox that is for all of us that you can really kind of make someone think about it. And I think that was the strength of the original. I don't think that this new movie necessarily retreads that because the original did it so well. But, you know, I think that's an essential question of humanity is why is it that we are so kind to the people we love while at the same time standing up and applauding when Arnold Schwarzenegger rips someone's balls out?
Exactly. Oh God. I think about that all the time when I see that stuff now.
You know, and you can't answer that in any way that I think isn't going to acknowledge the complexity and the humor and the ridiculousness of how strange we all are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, someone wrote a good essay about Commando and how he was a psychopath. Yeah. It was very interesting a couple of years ago.
Well, the whole thing in American cinema is you give someone a reason to be violent so we can enjoy it. Yes. You know, that's what you do. You take away his daughter and then you're like, oh, now you can rip the guy's balls off. But anyway, I don't know. I digress. Thank you for having me, and I appreciate how much you guys enjoyed the movie and seem to have saw it for what it was supposed to be. It's a delight for me, I'll tell you that, after reading some of those Twitter comments.
the dregs of humanity are commenting. I mean, you know, no one has anything to say unless it's bad, or was it joy or outrage? Those are the only two things you could possibly express.
Yeah, mostly outrage.
Yeah, well, unfortunately.
Well, thank you, GJ. We're going to wrap it up here tonight. I'll put links here for his stuff on the website for the post, folks. We appreciate you tuning in. Hope this wet your whistle to go watch Death Race 2050. It's out on Netflix now. It's out on video on demand. It's worth a watch, especially if you're a fan of the original or if you're just looking for a batshit crazy time. This definitely is one of those films you should watch. So thank you, GJ. Thank you, Don and Andrew. And we will say goodnight.
Goodnight.
So long.